You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
It's not common one has the privilege of introducing a Pulitzer Prize winner, but it's fair to say it's unprecedented to do so for a writer who has just been bestowed said award for a memoir on surfing. When it was published last year, Barbarian Days, the hardcover, debuted at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list, and the New York Review of Books called it, quote, an utterly convincing study in the joy of treating seriously an unserious thing. Yet I'd guess that any dedicated surfer would dispute the notion that the art of surfing is in any way unserious. Like many of you in this room, I presume, as a SoCal native, I've both tasted the sweetness of riding a wave at San Onofre, and as well, I've tumbled in whitewater after a nasty wipeout. Translating that physical, ephemeral experience into words is partly what makes Barbarian Days truly epic. The deft elegance of Finnegan's prose surpasses any prior writing on the subject and invites the lay reader into a world otherwise closely guarded by experienced wave riders. Finnegan's obsession for surrendering to the mercy of the wave parallels and intersects with his other adrenaline-driven pursuit, that of journalist covering stories in some of the most dangerous spots around the globe. He has reported on the drug war in Mexico, internal strife in Somalia, the civil war in Mozambique, human trafficking in Moldova, and the smuggling of exotic species in Madagascar. His latest work, perhaps, resonates best here in Southern California, where, just like Finnegan, we have the privilege of living next to the water. Now, thanks to Barbarian Days, we have a new lens through which to study it, Finnegan's lens. His language is an attempt to demystify something far bigger than what, until now, words could ever attempt to describe. Aloud welcomes back William Finnegan to his hometown. He grew up in the valley, was first lured by the waves at Will Rogers State Beach, and spent part of his childhood traveling to and from Hawaii and an ensuing lifetime circling the world, developing his skill at reading waves. His journalism has been published in The New Yorker since 1984. He has authored 4 other books and has twice been a National Magazine Award finalist. He is this year's recipient of the Pulitzer Prize for Biography. In conversation with William Finnegan tonight is David Renzin, author and co-author of 17 books, 7 of them New York Times bestsellers. They include All for a Few Perfect Waves, an oral narrative biography of rebel surfing icon Miki Dora, who, in Renzin's mind, is the greatest surf story never told, The Mailroom, an oral history of what it's like to start at the bottom, dreaming of the top in Hollywood, and Devil at My Heels, the autobiography of World War II Olympian Louis Zamperini, the hero many of us came to know through the recent big screen production Unbroken. Renzin visits us from Ventura, where he lives and surfs. Please help me in welcoming these 2 talented writers to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
So what do you want to talk about? I wanted a show of hands. How many people here are surfers or have surfed? Oh, hey. All right. Well, first thing I want to do is just congratulate you on the Pulitzer.
Thank you.
And I know we were talking about... Has it sunk in yet?
No, I hardly know what you're talking about.
I think I asked you earlier, they didn't call you, you said?
No, I saw it on TV and I read it in the papers, but I haven't yet heard from them.
Well, one of these days, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess they'll call you.
I heard there's a dinner and, you know,
is
a medal or something.
Money goes with it, no?
Maybe, but I really don't know.
Has it really hit you yet?
Well, it's been a few weeks. There have been a few nights of celebration, yeah. But I've really been tried to sort of stick to my knitting, and I've been working and not thinking about it much.
You say it. Your workload suddenly doubled now because of...
Yeah, there's a fair amount of... I'm interviewing, reporting, writing, doing what I do, and people are calling me wanting to interview me in connection, I think, maybe with that prize, but also just, you know, talking about the book, so...
So this autobiography, this memoir, Cheryl Strayed said that memoir is about more than what happened. It's about making sense of what happened. Mm. And Mary Carr, I think, on this stage said memoir is like knocking yourself out with your own fist. So, you know, I want to know if... how is memoir different? I want to know if that rings true to you. And you know, how memoir is different than reporting.
Mm. Yeah, it's it's a weird genre for a reporter, for sure, because you end up sort of investigating your own memories, as it were, reporting them out. You think you know what happened, but you need to check and make sure you have it right. And so I ended up looking up a lot of long-lost friends, frenemies, and trying to recall together things that happened. Of course, you know, memory's notoriously unreliable, and so it's always a different version. And there's all the negotiation around that. And I had plenty of archival materials, good journals, and a lot of letters returned to me. Those were invaluable. But...
Letters, yes. Not just returned on your request, you mean?
Yeah, unopened, yeah. No, I sort of put out a request. Some lots of letters I thought would be really useful were lost to the winds, but others came back were really, really helpful. But the whole thing of memoir is very, you know, it's private life we're talking about, right? It's,
right.
You know, nothing was on the record. So you give yourself license to depict, you know, friends and loved ones and all these shared, unguarded moments, usually many years ago. And that's a big arrogation. You know, you have to think long and hard about what to include and what to leave out. And some of the discussions are quite difficult, you know. And some are comic. I mean, as I say, I went back to... lots of old friends and had some crazy, you know, cross purposes. But I remember the British edition, they've got really tight libel laws in Britain, so they wanted me to go back and check this and check that, virtually get people to sign waivers, you know, yeah, it's okay, he wrote that about me. And some of it I really dreaded. I had to talk to a woman here in California whose life I had described as one long middle-aged orgy. And I just thought, this is not...
I don't remember that in the book.
But. I don't think it's been cut. Anyway, I went and told her, and she said, you wrote that? You put that in your book? That's great! And she's like 89 now, you know, and she's just happy to have it. Some people are, you know, proud of their rowdy past, but you never know. And other people would be appalled, you know, that I had written about some episode that I thought was perfectly reputable from their past. So,
have you gotten some feedback though from other people about how they were portrayed? That
not too much, because a lot of it I'd sort of negotiated beforehand or, you know, discussed with people. I mean, in a book like this, there's no chance that everybody depicted is going to be happy with their depiction, but. The main characters all seem to be fine.
What did you think you remembered that you found out you really didn't remember?
I mean, there was one whole sort of key scene that I went over and over with. I think I shouldn't probably disclose which one. With the keeper, the other person involved. And when it was all done and I thought we had it agreed, she said, oh, and one more thing, like one more email, one more thing, you weren't there.
This wasn't like a sex scene or anything.
It might as well have been. I mean, it was so, not just intimate, but it was so specific. And we'd gone over, I remember this, and finally we'd settle on a mutually agreed version, and then I wasn't there. And the way it worked, and without giving away too much, it was sort of her big moment, and I was more a witness. And I felt like, okay, she's wrong, but I'm going to defer to this in some way. I'll sort of smudge the writing so it won't be... I said, well, how do I know all this then? And she said, well, you must have come on the second or the third time, but in the big discovery, you weren't there. And so I just sort of smudged it, you know, this happened.
But you were there.
I was there.
Interesting. A lot of the stuff you've said you got from journals.
Yeah.
I mean, how diligent were you in keeping the journals? And how rigorous? And did you do them with the future in mind? Talk about the idea of, you know.
Not too much. I mean, I have a whole shelf full of journals, you know. I mean, really, I wrote a lot when I was younger. I've stopped. I now get paid for writing, and nobody's paying me to keep these journals. But they weren't. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of just like self-analysis and self-laceration, and you know, what am I doing with this scene and this thing? I mean, just stuff that's useless to memory. But plenty of material I was able to draw from and use in the book, and a couple of key points where I felt stuck, and I had a hunch that my companions of that time, and the book's really kind of built around friendships. Who are either also writers or at least diligent journal keepers, would have maybe stuff they could dig up and recall for me. My friend Brian was one of them, one of the main characters in the book, and my first girlfriend, Karen. And they each produced journal pages, heavily redacted. and I assume those were all, you know, like complaints about me. Or something, or I don't know what.
They Xerox these?
Yeah, exactly.
So you couldn't hold them up to the
line. No, and they were, but their journals were so much better than mine. I mean, they were really as if kept for future reference. I mean, great detailed lists of what was in the shop in Samoa, you know, just every thing on the shelves. And that's what I was looking for. Thank you. And it all started, you know, the Proustian Madeleine started coming back to me then. And so I wish I'd kept journals that good.
That's when you call them up and say, why don't you write this book? Well, I mean, I kept journals too, and I look at them now and they're embarrassing.
Mm.
You?
No, mine are pretty bad, but the returned letters were actually maybe more useful overall in that I'd struggled. This book took about 20 years to write, and somewhere in the middle of that, still dithering over it, you know, should I really do it? Can I really write this kind of thing? I got out of the blue a package of old letters from a friend, my best friend in high school and junior high. Somehow these had been kept, and they were the letters I'd written. We moved to Hawaii when I was 13, and my dad got a job over there. I grew up here, and so I wrote back to my friend in the mainland, you know, just every night it seems like. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of letters, hundreds of pages, big, long, handwritten letters, which were terribly embarrassing, ridiculous. I mean, the writing.
This was to Dominic?
Yeah, Dominic. And yet they were so rich in detail, and reading through them, I knew this is the spine of, and this is the first chapter, and they form the spine of the first chapter. You know, a lot of it's about surfing, a lot of the letters, and about school, and, you know, my girlfriends, whatever was going on in exciting Hawaii.
Why did you write the journals? I mean, why, you know?
Why did I keep journals?
Yeah, why did you keep journals?
Well, I was a writer and always planning to write. And it was, you know, like everybody, I think, who keeps a diary, it's your consolation, your friend, your confidant. And And also, as a writer, your kind of record and raw material and where you try out things. And I mean, a lot of my journals at different points were about books I was reading, pages and pages, or even copying pages and pages of writing I loved. And it's nice, and it was probably good. You know, I was trying to internalize how Conrad or Joyce or someone put a sentence together, but it's not really useful. You can always pick up the book and find that.
That's
stuff.
Right. That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just said I was a writer. When did you know you were a writer? When did you decide this?
Pretty young. Like I'd say, I was in junior high in the Valley here, and we actually had a literary magazine. I'm not sure that public schools have literary magazines in junior high anymore, but it was a sort of golden age of public education, I think maybe the 60s. And
we had it good.
Yeah. I mean, the magazine wasn't any good, but at least we got to, and I was an editor on that, and I was churning out poems and stories. I loved to read. It came naturally to me.
So if memoir is about, you know, making sense of what happened, is that why you did the book? Or one of the reasons? I mean, I know you've said you wanted to show how you've threaded surfing through your life.
Mm. Yeah, rather than make sense, maybe, and to remember and to have a record, but also to kind of account for, I mean, one of the sort of overarching themes in the book is this, it's about, in part, this kind of struggle to become a responsible citizen, you know, become grown up, and equally the sort of struggle against responsibility.
Right, right.
Yeah. And in my bipolar life, surfing is very much the North Pole of irresponsibility, you know, just screwing off. Unproductive. I mean, the most useless thing you can possibly do. Chase waves all over the place.
Well, as Mickey Dore said, and I'll be happy to do it, you know?
Yeah. But equally, you know, I at some point wanted to become a sort of, you know, productive citizen in the ancient sense of the word. And that's a sort of central tension in the book. And yet I spent, you know, and for me, that's being a journalist and informing my readers, having opinions, I've been chasing waves for more than 50 years, and I sort of wanted to account for that side of my life, all the sort of nature worship and
account to yourself?
Yeah, a little bit to my, yeah, I suppose so. Nobody else really cares.
Guess, and, big surprise, they do, but.
Well. I'm really surprised by the reception of this book, because it's, I made an effort to tell stories and engage the reader. It did feel like I've written a bunch of journalistic books and serious books. And this one is, I think, finding more readers. None of those others won any big prizes that I remember. So it's ironic, maybe, because it was so much more personal.
Right, right. It's maybe the one you've avoided for a long time. The girl you are dating but can't commit to.
Yeah, I sort of backed into it. In fact, I primarily do political journalism. I didn't hear Maureen's introduction, but that's what I mainly do. Politics very broadly defined. I was doing that and freelancing and living in San Francisco and sent a little piece, first thing I'd sent to the New Yorker, just over the transom, and they took it. And it was at that moment when somebody in the editor's office said, if you want to write something long for the magazine, you should, this is a good time, you got the editor's attention, and you should propose something. And I thought that meant I had, 2 minutes right now, I have to go, I didn't have an idea.
Right, right.
And how about a profile of this guy I was surfing with at the time in San Francisco, who was a kind of a big, larger-than-life, colorful character. You could sort of picture him
Doc Reneker.
Yeah, Mark Reneker, and you could picture him as, you know, like a hero of a John McPhee piece of that period.
Right,
so
right.
I sort of proposed that and got the assignment. And then it took me 7 years to write that piece. I missed a couple of deadlines. And because
they
suddenly
had deadlines at the New Yorker?
No, luckily not. I mean, every now and then they'd remind me, you know, that this was still on the books. And I didn't just sit on my hands those 7 years. I mean, I was doing other stuff. I moved to New York during that period. But part of my hesitation was, you know, do I really want to come out of the closet as a surfer, among other things? And
but the minute you suggested that piece, you were out of the closet.
Well, only to them. I mean, it was just, that was a sort of, you know, private little proposal. Yeah, yeah, do it. And I wasn't so much saying I surf. I was saying, let me profile this surfer.
Okay.
Little do they know that to get a proper profile of him, you have to be out there with him. And this piece ended up being about the two of us and my own relationship to surfing as I was trying to, like, you know, start a career as a journalist and all that. But I had a concern, and it turned out to be a groundless worry, but that because I was writing political opinion columns by that point for the magazine, and I thought if I, you know, suddenly reveal that I'm a surfer, that I'm going to sort of not be taken seriously. Oh, he's just a dumb surfer, you know.
Did that happen?
It didn't. Like I say, it was sort of needless. I never heard anything about it, but I worried about it. So that was one of the hesitations. I was also worried that the main character wasn't going to like the piece, and indeed he didn't.
And he didn't.
No, he hated it. So I was right about that.
That's the first time I've actually heard the word hated it.
Well, I think that's a fair description. What happened?
Well, two things. First of all, why did he hate it?
I don't think we should be talking about this.
Okay.
I mean, he could speak for himself. I mean, he's a lovely guy. He's a friend. But I don't know. It was a two-part piece, and he said the first part was fine, and then the second part, the other shoe dropped, and I don't know. He just thought I was mean.
Mean to him. It wasn't that it was about you as well as him.
No. I think he thought I was, like, mean and unfair. But he should really speak.
Sure.
It was what happened was that when I was just a member, there was just a few people surfed in San Francisco.
Describe the scene there.
Yeah, it was kind of a small community. This place, Ocean Beach, a big heavy beach break, and kind of a scary place. And this guy was sort of the king of the. He was a big wave surfer and really articulate, really smart guy, but took up a lot of psychological space, I'd say. And when I was revealed as a reporter, like suddenly I was kind of talking to people with a notebook and other people just thought I was another guy in the water. They suddenly started coming to me with, you know, I was his Boswell, and so therefore they're going to register their opinion of him with me. And I discovered his position in that this little community wasn't so exalted as I might have thought. So to portray the community, I had to show some of this ambivalence, to give it a mild word. And that he wasn't very happy to read about, for understandable reasons.
Okay, that's good, because I've now forgotten the other part that I was going to say.
Oh, good.
I'm just wrapped, you know. You're there in San Francisco, and we're jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit, but you've just come home from a 4-year trip through the Southern Hemisphere. And as you say, you're trying to start your career, and sort of a balancing act between surfing and writing. Now, of course, you end up at Ocean Beach, which is like, here it is. Mm. And also, you're doing this story, which you, opportunity knocks and you jump at it. So all of a sudden, it's like The Godfather 3. You're being drawn back in, right?
To surfing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in that, as I say, during that long patch, which I didn't deliver the piece, I moved to New York and wrote, actually published 3 other books during that period. I was really doing this other stuff, but you're right, I was...
While you were there.
Yeah, in New York, but I had this piece on the back burner, finally finished it, and then I started backed into this book.
Right.
So that piece came out and got some attention, and my publisher at the time said, why don't we do this as a book? It was great, long, one of those big old New Yorker multi-part pieces. And I had enough material, but I said, no, I didn't really see this as a book, and the main character doesn't like it, and it just wasn't what I wanted to do. But in trying to talk my way out of doing this, I talked my way into... I kept saying, I know other guys who are so much more interesting than him, and other places that are... Okay, good, you know, sign here. And, I mean, it's nice to have your publisher want a book, but And I sort of backed into this that way. And then I sort of had it. I described it, but could I really write it? And the answer was sort of 20 years in the making.
Was it the same publisher who published it, who offered it to
you? Yes. Yes. I mean, we're at another publishing house, like two publishing houses
yes,
before.
Taken over by a few different ones, yeah. Right. But yeah, I mean, you resisted writing it because I think you said you thought that reporting on wars and famine and stuff took precedence over sucking your thumb about surfing.
Yeah, it felt silly and self-indulgent to do this when there were all these urgent journalistic topics. I mean, I mainly write about fairly hard subjects and they self-justify. I mean, there's this terrible conflict or injustice or thing that needs to be written about, as opposed to, like, who needs to hear about my hobby, really, you know, so.
Okay. We've jumped around a bit, but one of the great aspects of the book, and we have more surfing people here than I actually thought we would, and that's great, and thanks for coming out of the water, is that you wrote this book for non-surfers. You know, why? How do you approach it differently if you're writing for non-surfers?
Well, it's actually kind of a trick, you know, to describe surfing for non-surfers in any detail because it has its, you know, own language and sort of technical jargon. And so in this, I tried to introduce readers to the sort of the basic concepts, the basic terms of art, sort of gently in the first chapter or two, where there's a lot of action on land. And I was young and a kid in Honolulu and tried to make the stuff sort of go down easy and at the same time not, you know, bore surfers who already know what, you know, a set is or a peak or you know, any terminology about waves in the ocean. But kind of slip it in and feel like I've done the exposition that lets non-surfers get oriented in the water. And let's just say, but it's a bit of there's some sleight of hand there trying to, there's a little exposition section about how waves are formed and all that. And then just only once define these terms, there's no glossary or anything like that. So I think maybe if a non-surfer like drops into the middle of this book, in the surf scenes, which aren't, you know, all of the book by any stretch, but in the surf scenes, it might be a bit lost. Because by now I'm using the terms that I've introduced and defined. And to kind of get that right, I kept having friends, readers, like my wife, who have no interest in surfing, would you read this and tell me anywhere you're lost? And then repeatedly I'd hear about where, you know, the lingo was getting too opaque. And sometimes it was, you know, my wife saying, you know, what's a channel? How can you not know what a channel is? And that's not a surf term. It's like shipping channel. Come on. I don't know what the channel is here. Place where there's no waves breaking, you know. So sort of satisfy these few tough readers like my editor who, you know, don't know any surf terms. And then I think there's a certain charge to like, okay, you've got this. And now I'll tell a story more or less in the same language I would tell it to a surfer. I mean, not perhaps as profane and you know, and ludicrous, but still in the very language we use, and people are now with it, and they stay oriented. It's hard to tell a surf story, at least for non-surfers, that where people are oriented and feel what's at stake and how it's distinct from the other story, or you know how this spot. A lot of it's about spots and how waves work, you know, so much of surfing is reading waves. I mean, more than the athletic part, it's just understanding what waves are doing, understanding the ocean and sort of evoking that. And a fair number of people who have no interest in surfing have said to me, you know, this is just like my bird watching, or just, you know, this book is not about surfing, which it is about surfing, but I'm always happy to hear that, you know, it's about men or love or obsession or bird watching.
It's about my bird watching.
There you go. And it's because I take some pains to describe given spots that make them, it's very clear that a wave at Ocean Beach is nothing like a wave in Tavarua in Fiji or you know, somewhere very different. And people who may have seen the ocean as a kind of undifferentiated bunch of water, now are getting some of the distinctions.
To preface this, I want you to read that section about Honolulu.
Okay.
But just to preface it, you know, I came across something that Rainer Maria Rilke wrote in a letter to a young poet, and he said, "Things aren't all so tangible and sayable as people would usually have us believe. Most experiences are unsayable. They happen in a space that no word has ever entered, and more unsayable than all other things are works of art, mysterious existences whose life endures beside our own small transitory life." And I think you found the language to say the unsayable.
Thanks. I don't know. It's really... That. Let me try to read this again.
Now you'll show us.
I tried to talk while surfing the other day. It was a disaster. Like into a little mic on my rash guard. Where was that thing? Yeah, it was really...
Waterproof mic.
Yep. This is a... Oh, wait. Yeah. This comes in a chapter of the book where I've dropped out of college to go surf a wave called Honolulu Bay on Maui. I chanced to surf it and just really fallen hard for it. So I dropped out of college, moved to Maui with my girl, dragged my girlfriend who had no interest. At this point, I guess it's important to this passage. She and I have just broken up, but she, in her kindness, has nonetheless given me a new board for my birthday. And it was as a no small expense at that time. I was working in a bookstore. She was scooping ice cream. And the board was shaped by a guy named Leslie Potts, who was kind of the king of the hill at Honolulu Bay at the time. Wonderful surfer, but sort of an underground guy. I'd never heard of him before I moved there. And he wouldn't, I mean, I said what I wanted, and he said, I'll shape you the board you need. I've seen you surf, I know, you know. And he gave me this board that wasn't at all what I wanted, but he was such a wizard that, you know, you surfed the board he gave you. So that had just happened. And the glasser, his glasser, a guy named Mike, had at least followed my instructions.
And a glasser is someone who puts fiberglass around the phone.
Yeah. But the shaper, this guy was not only a wonderful surfer, this guy Leslie Potts, but he was a great shaper, and so I was lucky to get board shaped by him. So that's all the context you need here. As I said, Mike the glasser did follow my instructions. Here we go. Sometime in October, Honolulu started breaking in earnest. The setup was the same one we'd surfed in the spring. Long outside wall with warbles and sections. Then the big bowling section of the main takeoff. Then a roaring blue freight train all down the reef, deep into the bay. It was, once again, a glorious wave, with hues in its depths so intense they felt like first editions. Ocean colors never seen before, made solely for this wave, this moment, perhaps never to be seen again. To surf the place intelligently would require long study, clearly, an apprenticeship of years. But the Honolulu local guild was no longer taking applications. The spot already had an outsized coterie of devotees. They came from all over Maui, and on big swells from Oahu as well. The crowd at Honolulu had more dark faces than Lahaina lineups had. Lahaina's a town where I've been surfing that summer. In fact, not many of the regulars from the town spots appeared out there once the winter season got underway. The surfing was of a much higher caliber. At times, particularly when a swell was peaking, the action in the water felt completely frenzied, as amped, excellent surfers pushed their limits, wave after wave, and pushed each other. It was a tough crowd. Nobody gave a newcomer a wave. But successfully picking off sweet ones was less a matter of pure dogfight aggression, I found, than of getting into the rhythm of the sets and of finding the seams in the crowd. The whole scene had the feeling of a religious shrine overrun by passionate pilgrims. I half expected people to start speaking in tongues, to flail and foam at the mouth, or monastery monkeys to bomb us with guavas. The top guys were astonishing. Some were big names from the mags, some were local hotshots. I saw Les Potts out in the water only once that fall. He was riding a wide white board, the same shape as mine. The surf was mid-sized, the wind light, the crowd pretty bad, and Potts stayed away from the pack at the main takeoff. He lurked instead on the inside and used some form of advanced personal marine radar to dodge the sets and slip across the reef at improbable moments to catch large numbers of clean, fast waves that nobody else saw coming. His surfing was subtle and sure, and radical only when he saw the right moment, which did not by any means occur on every wave, to unleash some fierce maneuver. His knowledge of the reef appeared to be encyclopedic, and he concentrated on tucking himself into spiraling barrels over the shallowest inside slabs. I moved far down into the bay to watch him. The usual mob on the cliff, having come out to watch the show, couldn't even see Potts, I realized. He was down around the corner, basically surfing alone. My new board worked well. Watching Potts, I could see what he had in mind with the shape. I would never surf with such precision, but I found I could draw rounder lines, sharper curves, going higher under the lip than I would have thought possible on a racetrack wave like Honolulu. Surfing hard, putting my board up on edge, also put other people in the lineup on notice that I was not out there to watch them surf. It was a long trek up the pecking order, and I would never reach the first rank, but I began to take a place in the second rank. On certain days, I was catching as many waves as anyone, and people I didn't know were even hooting me into drops, encouraging me to go hard. If my surfing had plateaued when I was 15, it was now on a new upward track. I probably couldn't ride small Malibu any better now than I did as a grommet, but the size, speed, and soul satisfactions of Honolulu Bay were greater by orders of magnitude than any spot I knew in California, even Rincon, could offer. The wave was far more intimidating for a start, as well as more rewarding, and my obsession with it was well-timed, given how badly my life on land was going. Karen took up with Mike the Glasser. I couldn't believe it. She told me to call him Michael. He was nice, smarter than I knew, she said. They even turned up at Honolulu together, in his shit brown van. She sat on the cliff while he paddled out. It was windy and big, one of those rip-roaring, high-amp days. I had been in a wave-catching, mindless groove. Now I sourly watched Michael paddle cautiously up the bay. A set rolled through, and he headed for the horizon. He was, I realized, a kook. That's a beginner surfer, not a term of approbation. He was, I realized, a kook. That improved my mood. I went back to work, battling the scrum in the main bowl, intent on center stage. Maybe, if Karen saw me ripping on the board she gave me, or at least surfing competently, she'd come to her senses and take me back. After making a highline screamer that no one in West Maui could possibly have missed seeing, I looked for her on the cliff, but the shit brown van was gone. Michael had somehow reached shore alive, evidently. That seemed both improbable and unfair. Thank you very much.
Thank you and good night. That was great. That's fantastic. Time seems to go a lot faster up here than it does down there, probably. So you mentioned earlier about, one of the themes of the book is, you know, the uselessness of surfing or the indulgence versus trying to become a good citizen, but also about male friendship. And we talked briefly just about how it seems to me that you always have a surf buddy. So, you know, can you talk about, why it's different with a friend and why it's necessary?
Yeah, it's not true I always have a surf buddy. I've often surfed alone. But I actually don't write about it in this book. I mean, I specifically don't even write about places where I lived and surfed a lot and maybe even loved the waves. But I don't, without a friend to kind of remember it with, experience it with, or bounce it, without that, is that triangulation? I mean, that without the other person, it's lost, you know? My journals aren't as good. My memory of it is not as good. It feels like this kind of masturbatory memory. and it's not out of a relationship. And whereas like getting to know a place and getting a wave wired with someone else, Honolulu Bay was a little bit lonely. I had a good friend come and we surfed it together. And I mean, I'd actually intended this book to be a series of stories about male friendships, you know, this place and this guy and this place and this guy. I kind of initially crudely proposed it while trying to back out of something else. and that scheme was way too rigid and not that interesting. And in fact, Karen, the girl mentioned in here, took over that Maui chapter. She just took it over, enough of the boys, and she's a better character than anybody else around there. So the structure didn't remain so schematic. But all these places I do write about, I mean, the chapters are kind of based. There's a chapter about Madeira, this Portuguese island where I spent a number of winters, and a couple, there's one in the South Pacific where I was traveling with my friend Brian. And without Brian, I mean, it's like the trip would have been meaningless.
Right. I mean, the relationship between you and Brian, I mean, 4 years sleeping in the same...
He didn't actually last the whole 4 years, but it felt like 40.
So. Well, you also say that after you had a guys had a big fight and it was only 2 weeks into the, trip and you almost left.
Yeah, yeah. So there's all the sort of, you know, there's just so much. I mean, yeah, with us, it was these like two big egos in one little tent, you know, for months. And he's also a writer and a surfer and he's my best friend, but it was, you know, fairly stormy. And that's as much of the story as anything to do with, I mean, the waves weave into that.
You know, as I noticed, you say Karen didn't really care about surfing, right? And neither did Sharon. And neither does Caroline.
These are women in my life.
In your life.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, it's worked out.
Caroline is your wife, right?
Yeah. She profoundly doesn't care. She has never, I mean, I feel like she's never seen me surf. I mean, I've dragged her to plenty of places, including Madeira. And here I am out here, it's kind of like in this scene. I'm surfing. Did you see that one, honey? No, it's so boring. She says it's the most boring thing in the world to watch surfing. And she's willing to come, but she's always got her nose in a book or so.
But given some of the incredibly dangerous and challenging scenes, you know, I mean, especially if we have time to read about Madeira, maybe it's, she's like, doesn't want to see it.
She doesn't worry too much. I mean, there's that scene we were talking about. If you like, I could read it, but, this is a tough moment. What, do you remember what page it's on?
It's page, 392, or near there. You have a different pagination, right?
Maybe, yeah, I'll find it. This is a sort of close call that I had in Madeira when I was, you know, old enough to know better. I was in my 40s by then. And it ends with a little scene with my wife. Maybe here. I'm out alone, actually, at this place called Punta Pequena, and it's getting bigger, and there are a couple other guys out, but they kind of disappear, and it's a relatively mellow spot for Madeira, which is it's got no continental shelf, sits out there in the middle of the Atlantic and gets these huge swells in the North Atlantic, and it's all cliffs, and gets really big and really good, but... So I'm out this day and it's getting bigger. I thought about going in. Caroline was leaving for New York the next morning. I was going to stay on for a month or so. I decided to catch one more good one, but it was getting bigger now, and I was surfing sloppily. The takeoffs were intimidating, but not difficult if you knew the wave, which I did. Still, I managed to blow two and take another set on the head. Now I was exhausted. The sets were step-laddering, each one bigger than the last. It was at least 10 feet now. The other guys were somewhere out the back, not in sight. I decided to catch the very next wave I could and go in. I found a nice medium-sized wave, possibly the first of a set. I caught it, shaky with relief. Then I managed to fall off. I popped up, annoyed, and found myself looking at a wall of water that seemed to have marched out of my worst nightmares. It was already pulling water from the shelf, pulling me toward it, and there was no chance at all that I could escape it. It was the biggest wave I'd ever seen at Bacana, and it was already starting to break. I swam toward it hard and dove early, but it plucked me out of the depths and beat me till I screamed in hopeless protest. When I finally surfaced, there was another one behind it, just as big, just as malignant. There seemed to be a bit more water on the shelf. I swam to the bottom and tried to get a grip on a rough slab of rock, but was instantly ripped away. Another long, thorough beating. I tried to cover my head with my arms in case it dashed me against the bottom. It didn't. I eventually resurfaced. There was another one. It was bigger than the others. But the important thing about it was that it sucked all the water off the shelf. Boulders started surfacing in front of me. And then I was standing in a field of rocks, in rushing, waist-deep water. I did not understand where I was. A field of rocks had risen out of the ocean, quite far from shore. At a break, I thought I knew. In a lifetime of surfing, I had never seen anything like this. The wave mutated into a hideous, boiling, two-story wall of white water, almost without breaking. It had run out of water to draw from. I had a moment in which to decide what to do before it hit me. I picked a fissure in the wall and threw myself up and into it. The vague hope was that if I wriggled in deep enough, the white water might swallow me rather than simply smash me to pieces on the rocks. Something like that occurred, apparently. My feet were sliced up from the leap, but I did not hit the bottom as I ragdolled shoreward in the bowels of the wave. And when I next surfaced, I was in deep water, in the channel east of Pacana, safe. I slowly made my way back to Jardim. My brain seemed to have shut down. I had for a moment expected to die. Not in some vague future, but right then and there. Now it was hard to see quite how to re-enter the world. I reached our hotel. Caroline saw that something was wrong. She ran a bath. I don't normally take baths. I lay in the water. Night fell. She lit candles. She cleaned the cuts on my feet. I tried to explain what had happened. I didn't get far. I said that I wanted to go back to New York with her. She washed my hair. I asked why she didn't get angry about all the stupid, risky things I did. She knew I was talking about war reporting as much as I was about surfing. She said she assumed I needed to do them. But didn't she worry? She took a long time to answer. When things get bad, I think you get very calm, she said. I trust your judgment. That was not how I saw myself, or ever had. Still, it was interesting to hear. She later admitted that she permitted herself some magical thinking, particularly when I vanished into conflict zones and kidnapping hotspots. I stayed on, too ashamed to leave, whimpering to myself after Caroline left. And then it goes on with more Madeira. But.
Let's talk about surfing and work. You moved to New York. How do you negotiate the demands of surfing and working? I mean, you still surf.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you said you made yourself available for assignments where there were waves.
True.
You know?
Mm.
How does the work raise the bar for surfing and the surfing raise the bar for the work?
Mm.
If it does.
It's just sort of this kind of delinquent thing at this point, you know, where there's pretty good waves around New York. People don't, I think, realize that, especially in the winter. It's cold, but it's really good. And Jersey Shore and South Shore, Long Island. And so local surfing, I also take trips when I can and try to combine reporting with surfing when I can. But it's really, I don't know how we did it without computers and, you know, online surf forecasting, which can give you a really sure sense or the surest possible sense of where and when it might be good. But I have a little crew of guys I surf with, and then we all got jobs and families and juggling all this stuff. And you're trying to see the window when it might be good, you know, and these short days in the winter, it's usually small, and it's at least an hour to get in the water from where we live. And so it's a lot of lying, you know, to editors. A lot of just excuse making of all types and a lot
they
of working.
Already, they already know, though, right?
At one point, it was so obvious. I mean, I was missing deadlines and and just flaking out, disappearing, not being at your desk. This editor was pressing me on the website, I write for the website now too, and this editor was saying, I know where you're going, I know what you're doing, and you know, and so I was saying, wow, it was really good, you know, Jersey Shore was just so swell. And he said, I know, that's, you know, why don't you keep a blog, because they're always looking for bloggers, you know, about your, like, surfing around here. And I thought, yes, you know, I could, like, make copy out of all this delinquency. And, you know, these salty characters and these goofy things we do and all the, and the guys I surf with who were pretty amusing. But then I ran this idea past them and they all said, absolutely not. you know, blogs are lame and you're going to give away our spots and absolutely not. So
you guys got the right stuff. That's the right stuff. You talk, you know.
Although later I thought, they appear in the last chapter of this book, a couple of them. And I sort of was then thinking, how is this going to go over? But when I said I'm writing a book, they said yes.
Yes. You know?
They were happy about a book. There was something okay about that.
Paper.
Yeah.
We just have a couple more minutes before we're going to start taking questions. I just wanted to ask you now about aging.
Mm.
Because, you know...
this... universal disaster, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you said you had in an interview you had a close call in Hawaii that made you want to dial it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're a barbarian in winter. I say that in a complimentary way.
Yeah.
Does your blood still boil to surf?
Yeah, yeah, it's still the same. In fact, I was back at that same place about 2 months ago where I had that close call I mentioned in the book. It's horrible getting, I mean, everybody knows who surfs and is, you know, beyond their prime. It's just horrible. You just get worse every year. You know, it's just like no denying it. You get weaker and slower. You need a bigger board and all that. So you just, you know, fight it. And I actually surf bigger waves now than I used to.
Why?
They're easier. They're, you know, for the old fart, it's somehow easier to, there's more time, the whole thing happens on a bigger scale, there's more push, there's more vertical. You can pop up much more easily as your board kind of falls away from you.
Right.
And in the winter, East Coast, small, quick, all that rubber, it's, you know, it can be really discouraging. So there's that about aging.
Yeah.
And surfing. And kind of holding your place in the lineup, you know, where it's crowded, there's a lot of competition for waves, and it's really primitive, you know, it's a real sort of dominant submission dance between the people in the water and you know, show you can do it and rah, you want it and all that. And as you get more inept, you your place in the pecking order drops. It's terrible. I can't recommend it.
How do you stay in shape? Do you exercise? And
I supposedly swim a lot, but they just closed my pool and I'm just kind of going to seed now.
But you know, in the end of the book, you're at Cloudbreak with Inya, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a poignant moment because you're trusting this guy now to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
And you know, the at the end, you just say, "I just don't want it to end."
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wasn't trusting him because I was old. I was trusting him. This is a Fijian guy. It's a big sort of double reverse in the book that it should end like this. There's a, the title partly comes from a famous quote from a Calvinist missionary, a New England missionary sailing into Hawaii in 1820, the leader of this band of missionaries, who was horrified by the sight of people surfing as they sailed in, these half-naked savages, these barbarians. You know, we wept to see them, you know, and he wrote about this when he left 27 years later, Hiram Bingham is his name, about how, you know, the advance of civilization can be measured by the discontinuance of the use of the surfboard. I mean, they really saw surfing as a key to suppressing Hawaiian, you know, fun culture that wasn't Calvinist and full of business values and getting people into the cash economy. I mean, the main weapon, of course, was not used consciously, but Hawaiians died, were decimated literally by disease. Anyway, they nearly stamped out surfing. So that quote forms a sort of backdrop early in the book. And then at the end, in this final scene, I'm out at Fiji, this place called Cloudbreak, with a Fijian guy, just the two of us out. And he turns out to be a lay preacher. And the waves get really intense. I took a bad fall, and I was coughing blood. And he was saying, oh, we got to go in. You're hurt. And I said, I think I'm all right. But he wasn't so sure. He was working for this resort where I was staying, and he should bring the guest in. So it was this ludicrous situation. And then he decides, okay. And he's so into the – but the whole time he's saying he's evangelizing me. He's saying, Bill, do you know God? Do you know God loves you? And I'm saying – I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure he does. and we're having these sort of theological debates, and he's like fired up to convert me. And these waves, amazing waves are coming. These big kind of walls that are all indistinguishable to me. And I've agreed that he's agreed that I can keep surfing, but I'm going to be really conservative and not fall. But you can't really. And he starts distinguishing. He starts saying, no, not this one, Bill. This is bad. It's going to close out, as we say. You know, you won't be able to make it. And then the very next one looks identical to me, and he'll say, yes, this one is good. And I just completely put myself in his hands. And the point of that was, I say, not that I was, it's that I couldn't see, I couldn't understand what I was looking at. He was a local guy, and this was like a supreme demonstration of local knowledge, which is right. A big theme in the book,
right?
Understanding what you're seeing. And I wasn't able to see what was going on. And he just kept calling me into ways that everyone he was right. And they were all, the ones I got were makeable, and a lot of others were not, and I just completely relied on him.
And you didn't want that to end, but you don't want surfing to end.
Yeah. So that's how the book ends.
All right. Well, thank you. I have another hour or two of questions if we want to stick around. But anyway, we're going to take some questions from the audience. And
it's actually two. I'll sneak in two questions. Where does your attraction to dangerous things come from? And when you go on assignment to someplace dangerous, do you take a surfboard with you? Do you travel with a surfboard?
On reporting assignments, I don't think I do. I mean, when I've managed to get waves while out reporting, like a couple of years ago in Madagascar, I found the waves and then I found a board. I was in Indonesia, a lot of surfboards in Indonesia. Wasn't surprised to be able to find a board there, but in Australia, a couple of different. But no, I always seem to borrow boards. No, I mean, it's nice. I mean, often you say, oh, the reason I surf so badly is because you're bored. no, it's helpful to have
it's
somebody
convenient.
Else's. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't feel attracted to danger. That's not, the great thing you seek in surfing, I think, for speaking for myself, but I think for a lot of others too, is to get right next to a lot of natural violence, but to get right next to it. And it's really just this kind of drenching experience of beauty. And the danger, you'd hope to keep at bay and keep under control. And there's some risk in it, obviously, to get that close to something so alive. But that's not the, as with reporting, I've tried to, stop war reporting since I became a parent, but I still do some pieces, and I've been writing about organized crime in Mexico in recent years that are in, you know, kind of no man's land and seem like, or not no man's land, but in, you know, contested territory. And yet the point is to find out what's going on there, not to take chances, certainly not to get hurt or kidnapped or anything like that. And so it's not that. Those risks are just happen to be next to what I'm interested in and what I want. And there's a kind of, there's adrenaline obviously in both these kinds of things. And there's a broad analogy, but it's more to, you know, some people have said, oh, you spent all these years chasing waves and it was like preparation for the reporting you ended up doing for a living. Where you go to strange places that you can't understand and you try to figure out what's happening on that reef, or, you know, you're talking to local people about what happens and trying to find the waves. Obviously it's completely different, but show up in a new country, a strange situation, and trying to find out who has the power, what are they doing with it, what happened here, how do you live? And I'm comfortable doing that. And that does kind of grow out of surfing and some of the same.
It parallels your surfing.
There's a strong parallel there for me, but not danger itself. I'm not very fond of.
Thank you, Sarita. Mr. Finnegan?
Yes.
Do you still use a wooden board? Have you ever done any reporting on the Coast Guard, naval warfare, surfers, or submarine? And would you surf during a tsunami?
I haven't surfed on a wooden board, no. I haven't done any reporting on that group. I don't know if I'm even familiar with them. And tsunami. I had not a dream. It was like a bad midnight TV experience recently, you know, and there was this tremendous tsunami surging into San Francisco Bay. Maybe it was called Earthquake, this movie. I didn't see the beginning, so I don't know what it's called, but spectacular effects. I'm not sure you can surf a tsunami. You know what it's like. It's mainly a huge tidal surge.
It sucks the water off the shelf pretty much.
Yeah, and then it all comes rushing back in
yeah.
in a catastrophic way.
Yes, I actually need to thank you for a change your writing made in my life about a quarter century late. So I was a reporter in Zimbabwe. This guy came to this guy came to visit me to ask some questions about writing I'd done from Mozambique.
Yeah.
And I was a really good, competent reporter, but he came back with an evocative story about the people, which was just richer and more interesting than anything I could write. And Bill, you were one of two reporters whose work made me decide to do something very different, which I'm very happy with my career. So I just need to thank you for that.
We haven't seen each other in at least 25 years. Hello. We met in Zimbabwe. Yeah.
First, thank you for the wonderful book, and thanks to him for giving it to me for my birthday last summer. Looking forward to reading the Dora book, too. My question is about the chapter, The Shock of the New. Love to hear more about the shortboard revolution and your kind of the hold that it still appears to have on you for a couple reasons. One, it's a great chapter. It's added a lot to the writing on the subject, like that chapter and what Warshaw's written. Great side by side. Two, from that chapter on and for the rest of the book, there are all these moments of this sort of ambivalent relationship that you have with the longboard. It comes up a bunch of times. And it's a lot of fun. Three, I think your generation of surfers are unique in all sports. I can't think of any other sport that had a moment like that. And four,
we may only have time for one or two.
Just my reasons. Most of the real nasty arguments I hear in the water are between shortboarders in their 50s and 60s and longboarders in their 20s and early 30s. So anything that you didn't have room for in the book, any thoughts on it, what it means for you personally?
That's interesting. Surfing around here is so contentious. Compared to New York, strangely enough, people are really mellow in the water. You would never see that. But I saw a battle in the water at Rincon recently, an older guy on a longboard. So it was different. Anyway, I don't know if people know what we're even talking about here. There was a kind of design revolution in surfing in the late 60s, 67, 68, where suddenly surfboards went from being, you know, 9-10 feet long and big, heavy things. You could only surf in a kind of conservative way to these little things you see today or down in this direction suddenly, and it's quite different, much harder to learn on a little surfboard and harder to ride. Although this tragedy of aging we mentioned earlier, one of the things that happens is you give up and go ride a longboard because that's easy, you know. Stop trying to shortboard, you're too old. And I'm still battling with that. So that's some of the ambivalence you're talking about. No, I won't, you know, own a longboard or ride a longboard. But you can picture, those of you who don't surf, what we're talking about, probably, you know, that little one is, it's like a bit of a magic trick to surf. It barely floats him. You sit in the water this deep. How are you possibly going to get up on this thing? Well, you can, but it's much more difficult than a longboard. This chapter you mentioned, it's called The Shock of the New, after Robert Hughes, and it starts with a scene, and I think I write that there are very few corny Coliseum moments in surfing where, you know, there's no Super Bowl, there's no it all comes together kind of moment usually in surfing. There's competitions, there are contests, there are pro tour, but most surfers don't pay much attention, and that's not the main thing. The main thing is your experience. And but there was this day when I was 15, maybe 14, 15, at Rincon, Santa Barbara, Ventura County border, great wave, where I first saw a shortboard, and it was this moment where everyone was saying, "Oh my God, what's that?" And you, your eye virtually couldn't follow it. Your eye's not trained to, like, this guy would, big, beautiful wave, and this guy would sort of lean into a turn, and then he was over here. You don't know how he got from here to here. It had an acceleration that was not, never seen before, and nobody seen before. He was riding this deep V bottom. I don't even know how long or short it was. Turned out to be a guy named Bob McTavish from Australia, who was not famous, but was one of the progenitors of the surf, of the shortboard. And he rode this long, and like people, we ran across the beach to stare at it, and he just kind of, "Hey, good day," you know, and headed off, and there was no big, you know, interview or anything, but we were sort of, "What is that thing?" And what, so I write about that. And here's the reason I describe that in detail. I got, day before yesterday, an email from Bob McTavish. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, email from God. I mean, it's just how, this guy has email, this guy exists in the world, I can't believe it. And he, furthermore, I wish I had my phone and I could read it to you, because, I mean, he might not appreciate it, but it was private, but it's just a couple sentences, and I haven't written back to him yet, but what he said was, I just read that scene, he said, 45 years later, he said, "I'm so happy somebody saw it." And he said, "I've told people that was the best day of surfing in my life." And nobody, yeah. And nobody, none of his mates in Australia were there. He was just in California. But that day it came together. So in other words, I didn't imagine it. He didn't imagine it. Thank you, you know. And I'm going to write back to him, "No, thank you," you know. So I don't know if I've answered your questions, but
we have time for one more question that can probably be answered by yes or no.
Hi, David. Hey. Larry Larson.
Hey, Larry.
We went to school together a long time ago. Do you, either of you, this is the question to both of you, read surfing memoirs? And I mean, there's a lot of them. And do you read them, and which ones do you find, do you like, or have you liked?
I tell you, I know there are a few, and I haven't read them. An oral history, well, you probably know this, of Mickey Dora. That's a different kind of book. It's a real creative sort of archival thing that's not at all like a straight biography. But most of what I love in the literature of surfing, such as it is, and it's pretty thin, are like Warshaw's Encyclopedia of Surfing, History of Surfing. I mean, they're just strictly, I mean, they're like technical books. They're for obsessives. They're, if you can, like, right, never get enough detail, Matt Warshaw is your man. And those are the books, or Surfing Guide to Southern California.
Oh, yeah.
This book that I sort of grew up on, you know.
We both have our original copies from 1965, right?
So those are the books I love. And I know that there are these others out there, but I must admit I haven't read them.
I like Becoming Westerly by Jamie Brissick.
Yeah, me too. I have read that one. I take it back.
Yeah, that's about a famous surfer in Australia who had a sex change operation, went from man to woman. But he's like, it's a great story.
Yeah, and it's beautifully written. That's a whole different thing in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, Peter Druyan, formerly, like, now Westerly.
Westerly,
Wendini,
yeah.
Formerly Peter Druyan could never have written this book. It was Jamie who wrote the book and really did it. But there's actually, in Australia, Druyan is Australian. there's a whole shelf of surf books, and I wasn't really aware of it so much. When this book came out, I kept getting reviews where they'd say, you know, as opposed to all these other surf books, and I was saying, what surf books? Well, it's a genre there, and surfing's really popular there, and I think there are some bestsellers, but you know, autobiography of this champion and that champion, and I even had interviewers call me and saying, where are the naughty bits, you know? Like, this is a surf book. You've got to have the naughty bits in the... And when you were a coked out, guy in the gutter, where's that? I don't know what you're talking about. Well, they all have to have that, you know? And they have to have a ghostwriter. And it's funny to be reviewed in that con... And also people saying kind of enthusiastically, finally a book for the rest of us. You know, this bloke spent his 20s under a palm tree, just like we all did. And you don't really get that kind of review here because reviewers didn't spend their 20s.
On the other hand, I was just in Auckland and I went to a bookstore to look at their surf section. And there's only two books there, his and mine.
Yeah. Where's all the coked out surf stars?
Yeah, right.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.